Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is one of an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Over the past 10 years, Richmond's cultural art scene has been quietly growing, attracting numerous talented artists with national and international reputations. Every week on Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we're having lunch with Steve Jones. Steve, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Tim.
And we were downstairs. What were we talking about downstairs before this that was so funny? What was that?
That was so funny.
Yes, I don't know. I can't remember. Well, anyway.
I'm sure it was very interesting.
Oh, I know what it was. We were talking about how our memories aren't any good anymore.
That's right. Yeah.
It was something like that. I can't remember. I'm sure it'll come driveling back into me here.
Yeah, eventually.
Okay. As most of our listeners out there know, this is sort of a... And the show is sort of an attempted autopsy on art, as one person put it. So let's start off with autopsying you. And if you just lie down here on the table. Folks at home,
sounds
I'm sorry
great.
You don't have a visual of this. But
yeah.
tell us a little bit about yourself so I don't have to read a resume.
Oh, Lord. Born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. Educated at the Art Institute of Chicago and lived there for 8 years. Worked as a performance artist in Chicago for 8 years. Late in life, age 37, I believe, went back to get a graduate degree at BCU.
Do you know 37 is the new 12?
That's right.
Okay, so.
To be back there now. Went to BCU, got my graduate degree there. I work as an artist and a writer and a teacher. I write art criticism, teach painting, art history. Make a meager living doing both.
Right. I think most people I talk to are making a meager living, but most of them have amazingly made a tremendous amount of peace with that.
Yeah.
Have you?
I've made, philosophically, yeah.
Yeah?
It's just practically, right. You know, it's just when the bills can't be.
Because I think that's one of the things a lot of people listening maybe don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, how do you get to a place in your life where you're not driven by, even though you know, all of us say we're not driven by, but not, I mean, a lot of people make their life decisions. They spend their lives working in a cubicle because they think they can't survive without that $35,000, $45,000, $55,000 a year.
Yeah.
You're smart. You're talented. You could dump all this and go get a job in a cubicle. What keeps you out of the cubicle, Steve?
Fear of death.
What?
No, I mean fear of spiritual, emotional, mental death leading to physical death. I can't do it. I'm incapable of doing that. I mean, I think I am reasonably intelligent. I've tried that and it nearly killed me. And I think many artists we're misfits and weirdos and borderline or genuinely mentally ill. It's only certain things we can do. I know that we're not supposed to promote this stereotype of artists, but a lot of artists are a little peculiar.
Okay, Steve, Steve, put your clothes back on.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Is the autopsy over?
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. It's largely practical reality.
Well, but is that mental illness? Because mental illness, I don't want to get into Foucault here, and I don't know much about Foucault. And for those of you who know nothing about Foucault, he's one of those French philosophers that nobody can understand.
Yeah.
But one of the things he does talk about is the whole sort of myth of mental illness, and it's what society, when I say it, it sounds so stupid. When he says it, it sounds so smart. But essentially, society's way of coping with, it has to do with power. It has to do with defining someone's place in that society, and if they don't fit a productive place in that society, therefore they must be mentally ill. And I'm sitting here thinking, maybe the people in the cubicles are mentally ill.
Yeah. Well, Artie Lang wrote a lot about the same thing.
Did they?
And he's not...
Yes. A long time ago.
And he's largely gone out of favor, I think, because of, scientific discoveries about the nature of mental illness. But he wrote about the same thing. How do we... when is nonconformity...
Right.
Become something pathological, or is it just a convenient label? Artists have always occupied, a strange position in society.
And is it pathology, or is it the friction created between that form of behavior and perception and the commonly accepted perception that friction that creates the pain, not so much the abnormality that creates the pain.
I think probably the former.
But I think we're a little far afield here, don't you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's all...
Well, yes. Welcome to How Are You Feeling? Hi there. Well, all right, so art. Art. Tell me about early work. What did you do? Performance art. Tell people what performance art is, because it sounds sort of like guy in a raincoat on a street corner. So what is it?
It can be, when I got to the Art Institute, I wanted to be a painter. I was also a musician, playing in a band, like so many art students. And the thing that was hot and happening, and I was told was the cutting edge of art, was performance. I was bright but malleable, and I was actually sort of directed into it. Performance art's been around. It has origins that go back to the futurists, the Dadaists in the early 20th century. No one can agree on the definition. I used to call myself a live artist.
So a performance artist does what?
Works in four dimensions instead of three or two.
So like sort of like theater?
Yeah. Well, that's the big debate. Is it theater? Is it experimental theater, or is it something different? And I don't care. Either definition's fine. But there was a really thriving performance community in Chicago at the time, and there was something that we called a cabaret-style performance community, which was really pretty cool, where you had lots of artists doing work in clubs, small spaces, instead of in the gallery museum system, and doing short works, often on themes and so forth. And it was pretty exciting. And my work tended to be political.
Tell me, what'd you do?
I used the sort of a collage aesthetic in a lot of my work early on, combining sound and visuals and so forth. Eventually, it became more driven by writing and by monologue.
I mean, is it something you can articulate on the radio, or is it sort of someone has to come and see this thing happen? Or? Was there a theme?
There were often themes. It was, at the time, I wasn't doing personal work. It was tended to be, like I said, sociopolitical in nature or philosophical. Art about art, which I think is what most students, art students, make art about, because they don't have any life experience yet.
Right.
And at the time, it seemed appropriate to be doing that. And it was
make
exciting.
Art about art. Was it exciting?
But it's funny. Why? Once
Why
I
was
left.
Was it exciting? What was it like? I mean, were you up on a stage in front of people?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you could get up there and do something and get booed, or
there was a time I got almost physically driven off the stage. It was a tribute to William S. Burroughs, famous cantankerous author of Naked Lunch, and I liked some of Burroughs's ideas. I liked his cut up technique, where he would like cut up fiction and then piece it back together. But I was invited to be on this performance art tribute to him, and Del Close, who's a very famous Second City teacher, he was on the bill. I was on the bill. And I was trying to come up with a piece like this, tribute to Burroughs thing, and the more I worked on it, it started to bother me, this kind of hero worship thing that was going on.
Right.
And it was such a boys' club mentality. And Burroughs was in some ways a famous misogynist. He thought that women were an inferior species of human. So even though I liked some of his ideas, what I ended up doing was writing this monologue that made fun of hipsters that wanted to go back to the beat era.
Right.
And so I got up there and I sang Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side to the Cordettes' Mr. Sandman. Right. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Walk on the wild side.
And I did, this ridiculous monologue about bringing Lenny Bruce, the great 50s comedian, to my Aunt Pat's house for Christmas in Kentucky, and how he started doing one of his bits, and they were so scandalized by this assault on bourgeois values that they killed him at the table and ate his body. And by the time I got to this, they wanted to kill me.
Really?
And it really disturbed me, because they had no sense of humor about this. Burroughs was an iconoclast, irreverent.
Right,
And they were like screaming, get off, get him off. And they dragged me away. And I remember this guy, as I was walking by, looked at me and said, you suck, really loud. And so that was, yeah, that was an adventure. Usually that didn't happen, but.
But I think that's good. I think that's good. I think you did it. I think you did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it might have taken them 10 years to realize it, but I think you nailed it.
Yeah. Well, at its best, that can be magical about that kind of work. If you can find the concept that sort of exposes, the lie or the question.
Is that what art's about for you?
Yeah, it can be.
Can be.
Can be.
It's not the ultimate.
Oh, you mean for me?
For me? Yeah, for you. I mean, is it about? God, is he going to say it? Drum roll, please. Is it about truth?
Yeah,
making art. I think we're done here.
No, I do think it's that simple.
It's a shame we don't run commercials on this thing. You know,
the problem is that people used to think there was truth, and then postmodern times there are truths.
Truths.
There are many truths as there are people who know what truth is. So,
right. Exactly. Exactly. So much for truth, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. That is interesting. That's very interesting. So, as far as that dilemma is concerned, does that surface in your work at all? So, I mean, let's back up for a second.
Okay.
We might have lost some folks here.
Yeah.
Essentially, in the thinking of art history, you have very sort of beautiful portraits, pastoral paintings, realism, and there are very strict rules and regulations and guides about what makes a beautiful painting and what doesn't, and it involves technique and it involves, training and skill and all those things. And then along come a bunch of bozos like Picasso and people like that. And they start, deconstructing all of that and moving noses around to the side of the face and throwing all the rules up in the air. And Duchamp comes along and hangs a urinal on the wall and calls it art. And somebody says, that's not art. And he says, why not?
Yeah.
Ergo, all the rules go out the window.
Yeah.
And art is whatever you say it is.
Yeah.
Where are you on all that?
I don't feel like I have much of a choice. I mean, everything's open now. I do believe anything can be art. I think that what you have to affix to that is the proviso that doesn't mean it's good art.
Ah,
and
yes.
I think this expansion of media and of what art can be is very healthy and a tremendously important innovation of the 20th century.
Right,
but it's also, anytime you have this huge expansion in terms of media and, when everything is contentious about what art is, what its purpose is, how you can make it, how do you critique it? It's harder and harder to know what is good.
Does it matter, though? I mean, if you've got 10 people who say, this is really great and I love it and it means a lot to me, and 10 people who say, this is terrible and it's crap and it's meaningless, then does it matter?
I think it's meaningless to the extent that art reflects the society that makes it, and art reflects the time, the zeitgeist, the time in which it was made. And so if the work that you're seeing is chaotic, formless, nihilistic, pointless, that
ironic.
Says something. Irony to the point of nausea, which we've seen, for 20 years, I think. I think it's a much braver thing to do to be not ironic.
Right.
Irony is so easy. So I think to that extent.
What do you mean by irony?
Where to start? I think that.
Just in terms of how it might be used in art.
Well, in one thing I mean by that is that there's a suspicion about any sort of direct, honest communication of human feeling, of human yearning, of spirituality. There's a cynicism about that where the only way it can be treated is ironic, which I think is very hostile to the human spirit, frankly.
Right.
My values are very humanistic. But what I love about art is the way it shows the unique fingerprint of the individual.
Right.
Seeing the individual vision. And I think that, we've had... it just gets to a point... I can't think of the guy's name, so this is libelous. But that sculptor who made the sculpture of the little woman that's 2.5 feet tall with the flat head so you can put a beer on her head.
Right. The perfect woman.
Yeah, and then excuses it with irony.
Right.
Or the artist who superimposed himself into a picture of Jews in a concentration camp with a can of Diet Coke and made it into an advertisement. It gets beyond being like a subversive new look at that idea and just to being... I think, disposable.
Yeah, you almost, I mean, you mean, don't mean to be dismissive, but almost like, whatever happened to bad taste?
Yeah.
You know, as my grandmother used to say, Timmy, that's really in poor taste.
Yes, yeah. No, I mean, and there's a whole trend that these, you know, enfants terribles who, like Damien Hirst and the brothers, I can't think of their names, who bought an edition of Goya's Disasters of War in order to destroy it, that sort of thing.
Right.
These are such pointless actions, and they're traceable back to Duchamp's kind of, you know, mm-hmm. subversive acts. Mm-hmm. But the context is so different. Duchamp led a meager existence and clearly wasn't doing this to become
no.
a superstar.
No, not
and
at all.
Clearly these other people are. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a major motivation. Mm-hmm. You get noticed if you do this sort of mm-hmm. thing. But I think that, I do think that, and this is one way that I guess, though some people would call me a modernist. I mean, I really do,
right.
I'm sick of a sense of ironic detachment about everything.
But, I mean, don't, I don't think you're alone there.
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah.
So
what's the next thing? I mean, it's interesting in art, one of the driving forces behind art these days is that almost capitalistic, it's the new improved art.
Oh, absolutely. And the result is gimmicky.
You remember last year's model?
Yeah.
Well, guess what? We're on to irony now.
Well, you get a...
I mean, is that capitalist thinking seeped into, or is it really an intellectual, rigorous intellectual journey to try and understand and explore sort of the ambient environment we find ourselves in, or none of the above?
The former, if I remember correctly.
What did I say? I can't even remember what I said.
No, I think it's...
No, the difference between it being a rigorous intellectual
yeah.
journey and one that's been totally polluted by capitalism, and,
yeah.
you know, if it ain't new, I can't sell it in my gallery. And if people aren't buying it, I don't want yeah. it.
And new becomes
so
shorter all the time.
Yeah, so therefore, is it art or is it commerce?
A very up-and-coming painter locally, you know, told me that after a show she had recently, you know, she was reviewed as saying this was the same as last year. Mm-hmm. Last year.
Right.
As if...
That her work was the same as last year.
Exactly, yeah. yeah. That there should be this sea change in the work in a year,
right.
which is ridiculous. It used to be assumed that a painter, certainly, until right. they were at least 35 or 40, hadn't even really hit a mature style.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I think that a capitalistic attitude has horribly corrupted art in our time. And, you know, you have a situation now where you have a, you know, terrific graduate school at BCU.
Right.
But you have gallerists sniffing around, you know.
Great
you have
image.
People, when they should be immersing themselves in this laboratory situation to become
right.
artists, who are already...
being hit on by gallery people.
Yeah, and they're
really?
All on the make. You know?
Really?
And
yeah.
and I think that's sad. I think that's a real shame.
Gosh, in a culture that is so... I mean, that's my theory as to why art is not appreciated in this country. And I don't think it is. I mean,
yeah.
if you go to, you know, to Russia and you bring in a great pianist, and you'll have everything from the poor... uneducated
yeah.
people to the wealthiest people in the country sitting in there listening with tears in their eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, that would never happen here, except maybe at the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, it's been replaced by a mass media spectacle and
mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of extravaganza. But I think that there is, I really do
well,
think that
people...
how
tragic is that for our culture?
Horribly tragic.
Yeah.
Figures
because
like...
Because most people will say, you know, well, no, first of all, I don't understand it. Second of all, like, you know, I don't get it. And it's boring. And I could have done that anyway, probably, if I'd wanted to. I mean, art is just basically dismissed. So why is it important to a culture? Well, I mean, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't say that on the radio.
Can I say that on the radio?
I don't know. We'll find out.
I guess we will. I think it's essential.
We're not here next week. I guess we couldn't.
I mean, this will sound corny to some people, but I think it's essential. It's an expression of the spirit of the culture. And I think that... you know, you learn more generally about any culture by looking at its cultural artifacts mm-hmm. than by reading its history. Or if
mm-hmm.
you put the two together, it's contextualized beautifully for you. You can see
right.
what they value. You can see what they're about. And But yeah, I also, it's the old, one of the oldest instincts of humankind, you know, is to make things. We, you know, to have right. an aesthetic way of thinking about things goes back tens of thousands of years. So it's clearly an essential part of our
makeup. Well, I have a theory that, I got dragged off a stage for one time.
Oh, really?
Saying, and you may drag me off. But I think the art of our times is advertising. And I think 100 years from now, none of this other stuff. It's like, yeah, and then there were these guys who were doing paintings and stuff. But, you know, it's like, but what do you want to really understand this culture and what their art was about? Take a look at this 30-second commercial that can make you cry about a car.
No, I think you're right. And yeah. I think that does represent our culture, but I think our culture is in irreparable decline. And I think it doesn't take much, you know, to come to that conclusion.
Especially if you watch television for a while. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, Desperate Housewives. Yeah. Housewives didn't used to be desperate, for God's sake.
Yes. Or there's a 24
when I was a kid,
news,
they were happy.
There's a 24-hour news channel I've heard of that if you watch, that'll depress the hell out of you for a while. But yeah, I mean, I want to get back to something you asked a minute ago about. Mm-hmm. So, what do you do? What's the solution? And I don't pretend to know, right. but I do feel. I think that what I did in my own work as an artist demonstrates my own conclusion. I abandoned the performance art and all that stuff years later and went back to making paintings. Huh. I wanted to make things with my own hands. I wanted a sense of craft. I tried to jettison every single quality in my work that was not uniquely mine. Huh. To put all of my emphasis on finding a unique voice. This is something we take for granted, like in music. You know, we say,
and that's the kind of thing someone listening might say, you did what? You know what I mean? I mean, it sounds perfectly normal to you and I.
Yeah.
But you know, people put all of their energy and their work into their careers, or all of their energy and work into their. But you just said, I put all my energy and work into creating a unique voice. Yeah. That's what you just said, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I believe.
Which
in.
Which I think
and that's
is heroic.
Too.
I think it's heroic. But you can understand how people kind of go, what?
Yeah. It doesn't mean I don't want to make a living and that I don't think artists shouldn't be rewarded for what they do. They should. Everyone should make a decent living.
Right.
But I do think, I mean, I am very idealistic about art in that way. It should have a transcendent quality. It should be outside of commerce in its intention. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the agreed upon definition of fine art versus, you know, the other arts has always been about that. Mm-hmm. That this is something that should exist outside of thoughts of commerce. Mm-hmm. Now, again, everyone has to make a living, but that shouldn't be the first consideration.
Well, and I also think, to be fair, there are people who are in commerce or in business who have that same crystallized, razor-sharp vision of what it is they are doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to be just sit here smug and, you know, artists are so cool and everybody else, you're a bunch of schmucks, because I don't think that's true. But I do think a lot of people are caught up in a capitalist system without asking enough questions.
Yeah.
But I also think there are a lot of people who aren't artists who have a similar process to what you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely.
Where they're in business and they're young and they're trying to make as much money as they can. And then at some point in time, their vision becomes very clear and very sharp, and they become internally committed to some particular thing.
Whether it's medicine or
whatever
science.
Yeah, or business or whatever it is.
They work artfully.
Yes, I think so. And that's the other thing that I see in our culture. I don't think artists are the only creative people walking around. I mean,
no.
It's like absurd.
No, and I think that's part of the weird situation we're in, where do we find this kind of idealistic, way of living that thinks of money last?
Right.
And I think you find it in lots of places, and mm-hmm. I think that living artfully, working artfully is a mm-hmm. terrific goal for artists and non-artists.
Mm-hmm. But somehow people who practice painting, sculpture, those kinds of things, they're the kooks. They're the...
Well, in a capitalist society, they are, because those are useless objects.
Exactly.
They serve no function.
Exactly.
Other than to contemplate.
They serve no material function.
Yeah.
They serve a huge function. But it's not a material function, ergo
but
worthless.
Emotionally, spiritually, intellectually, they serve a huge function. Yeah, but in a capitalist society, they're looked at with suspicion to some extent, because, well, what the hell use is that? You know.
Well, and you're also kicking up dust. I mean, you're also saying, hey, Mr., you know, gets up in the morning, goes to work at 9, comes home around 5:30. And you know, to be fair, there are a lot of people that live that way.
Yeah.
And I think probably younger. probably more between your 20s and mid-30s, usually around mid-30s, all of a sudden you wake up, you know, that talking head song of, you know, whose house is this, whose wife is this, whose life is this.
Yes.
but some people manage to make it
How
through.
How did I get here?
Right. Some people try to make it through the whole thing without ever looking up, you know.
I had
what
my midlife
the life uninspected
early.
Is a life not worth living? Is that what it was? Something like that. Didn't Chartreuse say that? Or no?
It was Socrates.
Maybe there wasn't. Was there a philosopher named Chartreuse?
Chartreuse. Yeah, I believe so. And
the great green thinker.
Verdigris.
Verdigris. Okay. Well, listen, we're getting short on time, if you can believe it. So, let's get back to your work and the kind of work you're doing now, which really is. I've watched it evolve over the last few years. Talk about that a little bit.
Okay. The work I do now, I call it painting. It combines elements of drawing and painting and printmaking. And I use a kind of a visual style that's very linear and derived from different sources from childhood, things I looked at when I was a kid, like comics and cartoons mm-hmm. and movies and stuff. I'm very interested in early visual stimuli on what I call preconscious imagery.
Your early visual stimuli?
Well, anyone's, but anyone's mine in particular, my mm-hmm. work. Things that I looked at before I was old enough to intellectualize it. I intellectualize everything I look at now.
Right, okay.
You know, what does that mean? What is the right. context? And, of course, when you're a kid, the first time you see something scary mm-hmm. or something sexy
right.
or something intensely weird, you mm-hmm. don't. You just have an emotional response.
Right.
So I use kind of a visual language derived from that to make figurative work that has narrative, sort of ambiguous narratives in different pieces. Mm-hmm. I butt up different paintings against each other, so they're sort of like film cells or cartoons, and you feel like you're going to follow a story.
Okay.
And it all takes place in
this... So they're triptychs, diptychs?
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of things.
And they all take place in this sort of dream version of the suburban neighborhood I grew up in Louisville.
Really? Okay.
And deal with sex, life, and death. Mm-hmm. All the stuff that... is under the surface of everything everywhere, but you know the white American suburbs are one place where we are especially good at pretending
right.
Nothing. There's never a shirt tail hanging loose.
Right, everything's copacetic. Yeah. What's interesting about your work is that it is it's very clean.
Mm-hmm.
It's very meticulous. I wouldn't use the word cold because that doesn't get it. I don't know, clean, crisp.
Yeah.
You know? And yet you're talking about, what? Would you say?
I would say it's very expressive
death.
And very, yeah. One of the things I wanted to do, and
I mean, what's
feel
the
like,
juxtaposition there?
Well, I think that
I mean, if you're talking about those issues, why not be splattering paint all over them?
I wanted to avoid that cliche. I wanted to show that you could make expressive, expressionistic work that was completely tight, where there was nothing visually ambiguous. In other words, you can make out each image instead of saying, see that cloudy, hazy area over there. I wanted you to see everything, but it still didn't quite resolve for you.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make a work about collisions, and one of those collisions was between the adult world and the child's world
mm-hmm.
when those things leak into each other. And another one was about this precise sort of didactic way of making lines and so forth versus this sort of emotionally charged content. I wanted to find a way to put them together.
Interesting.
And I feel like that's what I've managed to do.
Would you say that holds true for your own life?
Oh, God.
We got another 3 hours.
What was that?
Well, it sounds like, in a way, you've described your own, almost your own psychological landscape. You know, this sort of, you know, trying
Suddenly
to...
Suddenly I feel naked.
Yeah, I'm sure. But you know what I mean? I mean, trying to take all these things that are very, very important to you and how they interact with each other and the impact they have, and yet try and have it in some sort of organized...
Yeah. But that's sort of a classic, you know, form out of chaos thing mm-hmm. that we all have in life, and that's especially important in art too.
But most people don't mess with that.
Yeah,
you know,
they don't want to. They don't want to.
They don't want to mess with that. I mean, that's what you're talking about. Some pretty dangerous territory.
Yeah,
you know. So it's.
But it came out of.
Well,
a
again,
very...
I mean, it's interesting. Every time I have these conversations, I end up thinking the people sitting across from me have more courage than most people I know. I mean, it's really, it's astounding. You know, you get to the end and you go, God, I can't believe these people are doing this stuff. They are really pushing the limits. You know, or I don't know, maybe we already got thrown in the water and we're just trying to survive. I don't know. But whatever. But guess what? We're out of.
Oh, we're out of time.
We are out of time, I'm afraid. This has been great. This has
really been wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. I wish we had more time. Well, anyway, I want to turn to you folks that are listening right now. Probably have smoke coming out of your ears. that was hot and heavy and fast. But I want to thank you for tuning into Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you next Friday at 12:30. And one last time, this is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRAR 97.3 FM. It's indie radio. It's radio for the rest of us.